You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Economics for the People with your hosts, Sirisha Naidu and Taki Manolakos.
Nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender como esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se.
That was Somasoor by Anna Tihu featuring Shadia Mansour. Hello, I'm Taki Manolakos.
I'm Sirisha Naidu. Taki, I want to start with what the show is about. You and I have been economists for nearly two decades. We've been engaged in social movements in the US and elsewhere. We've both been involved in indie media, curating, editing popular articles on economics and politics. And I'm a professor of economics at University of Missouri, Kansas City, UMKC in short. And in my experience with many people who are not economists, students who are taking their economics classes, their initial reaction about the economy, about economics, ranges from mystified awe, anxiety about something too difficult to comprehend, or just plain apathy.
Well, in my experience, you know, when I tell someone that I'm an economist, their first reaction is they want to know something about the stock market. The stock market has been drilled into everyone's head by media, the educational system, that is the economy. But in fact, the stock market is only a component of the economy. The economy consists of so much more, including how much we earn, our wage, how long we have to work, our housing situation, how much we pay for rent, childcare. There's just so much more to the economy than just the stock market.
And economists sometimes like to make things complex and, and things are complicated for sure, but they definitely, I think they're also sometimes relatively easy to comprehend. And so in this show, we want to demystify the economy and economics and how it affects our lives, livelihoods, our communities, both local and global, and also the ways in which people resist how economy and society sometimes minimizes them, their economic and social concerns. The ways in which people come together to build a different world for themselves and find alternatives. And so how can we learn from them? How can we think through together ways in which we can build our communities so that they are stronger, they are better, they're more equitable? And that is why, for me, Anna Tihu's song, which you ID'd, Taki, it captures what we want to do in this show.
Yes, and let me provide you with an English translation of the lyrics. She says, "You tell us we should sit down, but ideas can only lift us. But ideas can only lift us. Walk, march, don't surrender or retreat. See, learn like a sponge absorbs. No one is surplus. All fall short. All add up. All the silenced, all the neglected, all the invisible."
And that's why this show, as you and I have, are working on it, it's not just about numbers and markets, but how the impact of these on people and communities and how we can build alternatives.
Professor Naidu, what is up?
Hey, Taki, how are you doing this evening?
I'm very excited about our first show on KKFI.
Oh, thank you to all the listeners in KKFI. To start off with, we're going to have our regular segment called Econ 101. In today's episode, we're going to talk about COLA, or cost of living adjustment, something that the UAW workers have been fighting for. We want to discuss why all working people should be interested in COLA, inflation, and its impact on them. What else do we have going on?
After Econ 101, we're going to be discussing with a guest of ours, Dr. Rajaswami, the topic of disaster capitalism.
Oh, such an important topic given all these disasters we've seen this summer and what does it actually mean for all of us. And then we round up our episode with Dollars and Cents Debrief, or DNS Debrief. It's going to be our regular segment. In this episode, Dollars and Cents co-editor Chris Sturr is going to interview Professor John Miller on the millionaire tax.
The millionaire tax. All right, let's rock and roll.
All right. So in our Econ 101 section, we want to talk about COLA and inflation. The ongoing UAW strike is historic. One of their demands has to do with something called COLA. Now, clearly, the auto workers are not striking for fizzy pop. So is it something that only impacts auto workers and union workers? And how is COLA related to inflation? Why should any of us care about it? Could we characterize the current inflation as, get this, greedflation?
Greedflation. Well, let's talk a little bit about the COLA concept. So COLA, as Sirisha mentioned, refers to a cost of living adjustment. And really, it's a very simple concept. All it is an increase to wages, salaries, or benefits in the case of Social Security, an increase that allows the benefit to keep up with the rate of inflation. So government benefits are, importantly, COLA adjusted. Well, specific government benefits, Social Security and Supplemental Security Income, they are not eroded by inflation. And the law says that when the CPI, or the Consumer Price Index, for wage workers and clerical workers goes up, then there has to be an adjustment to the benefit payment. In fact, for 70 million Americans, that increase will be 8.7%. in 2023.
Why is COLA important? And, you know, to understand that, we have to understand that our wage, salary, and income increases need to outpace the rate of inflation to really count as an increase. So what is rate of inflation? It's really just the change in the general price level. The wage or salary, the number on our paycheck, once we discount it using the inflation rate, gives us the real wage. And we really need to pay attention to this concept of real wage, because that is really what tells us whether we can purchase more than before and whether we can lead a higher standard of living. So an increasing real wage is really what we want, not just an increasing number on our paycheck. And so we get an increasing real wage if wage increases are greater than the rate of inflation. So how do we calculate inflation? The official inflation rate is calculated by a federal agency called the Bureau of Labor Statistics, or BLS, and that falls under the Department of Labor. And this agency calculates the average change over time in prices paid by consumer for what they call as a market basket of consumer goods and services. And, you know, like, it sounds fancy, but really it's just a fixed number of goods and services. How do the prices change over time? And this measure is known as the Consumer Price Index, or CPI. This index can be calculated for the US as a whole, but can also be calculated for various regions, rural, urban, Midwest versus East Coast versus West Coast. It can be calculated for a specific state, and so on.
What has happened to the CPI since the 2008 Great Financial Crisis, as people have come to call it? Well, interestingly enough, the CPI since 2008 has gone up by almost 40%. That's a whopping number, 40%. Can you imagine?
So that's a very, very large number.
It's a large number, and that means people's purchasing power has been eroded by 40% since 2008.
Purchasing power, in other words, the real wages haven't increased as much, and so their ability to purchase hasn't increased very much since that time. So within that basket of goods, if we look at food specifically, they were 11.4% higher in 2022 than 2021. And this has been the highest increase since 1979. And this is according to an analysis by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and they have based it on BLS data. So historically, food prices, in the last 20 years have only increased 2% per year, but you know, like I said, 11.4% between 2021 and 2022. But even within these categories, some food prices increased much more. So egg prices, for instance, and Taki, you and I have talked about egg prices going up, and they increased 32% in this 1 year time period. Prices for oils and fats increased 19%, and even poultry increased by 15%.
And let me give, just since we're talking about eggs, let me just give you a specific number for eggs. In January of 23, that is the beginning of this year, a dozen grade A large eggs, which are the eggs most people buy in the supermarket, cost $4.82 per dozen. That was compared to what happened last month in August. It had come down to $2.04 per dozen. So the price of eggs had just gone through the roof, which was symptomatic of the inflation we were having. And I think it's important here to highlight that we've kind of made it through the worst of the inflation. Inflation, like the price of eggs, has generally come down. It's become more moderate recently. And just to, you know, cite the CPI number, in last summer, inflation was increasing at a rate of about 9% per year. And this past August, August of 2023, it had come down to 3.7%.
Yeah, but Taki, I mean, yes, but you know, people have still paid a lot in the past, right? And in the recent past. So actually, NPR did this analysis and they looked at a shopping, you know, what would a shopping basket in a Georgia Walmart, you know, what the price changes were from August 2019 to December 2022. And what they found was that in August 2019, Quaker Oats 18-ounce canister cost $2.38, but by December 2022, it had gone up 73% to $4.14. And similarly, toilet paper went up from $12.97. This is a 12-roll toilet paper bundle from $12.97 in August 2019 to $18.96 in December 2022. So that's a 46% increase. So you're absolutely right. It has come down, but you know, people have been paying more and more over time. And so let's say if I had, you know, my friend Raina, if she was shopping for essential items, food, gas, etc., with $50 in her pocket, she would struggle to put the same number of items in her shopping cart compared to what she could 4 or 5 or 20 years ago. Taki, there are people who are suggesting that, that you know, in the past year or so, wages have been increasing, and that is what is causing inflation. So what do you have to say with that? Because to me, that sounds very, very implausible.
It is very implausible. Unfortunately, many people are stuck in the 1970s. And the simple reality today, we have greedflation going on. And in fact, the Economic Policy Institute has done a very interesting analysis. And they suggest that 53% of the increase in inflation is due to corporations just jacking up their profits. So the increase in the current episode of inflation that we're experiencing today is actually due to profits and not to wages.
Right. And they, of course, EPI or the Economic Policy Institute has not actually called it greedflation, but many others are calling it greedflation, right? So, you know, and really for us to understand whether workers are actually contributing to increasing prices or is it actually corporate profits, which in some cases have been record-breaking. Shell and some of the other oil companies, yes, you know, there have been kind of disruptions in their supply and they had to increase prices. But Shell, for instance, has seen the highest profit in, you know, in 115 years. So it's saying something about profits. And of course, we know this is true also for many, many, many other large corporations that they have seen very, very large amounts of profits in the last couple of years. Just to sort of summarize, inflation captures what is happening to the general price level. When inflation increases, it decreases the value of our wages, our income, our salaries. It decreases the amount that we can purchase. So we want to pay attention to inflation. Inflation can be calculated using the Consumer Price Index or CPI. And in order to keep inflation from eating away into our wages, we have a COLA adjustment, which is the cost of living adjustment, to ensure that the value of our wages, our income, do not decline. And so really, the UAW workers are fighting to keep or to make up for these increases in the price level or inflation and asking for COLA adjustment. But all of us should be paying attention to it. Perhaps in a better world, we could all ask for COLA-adjusted wages, COLA-adjusted salaries and income. So there you have it, folks. COLA, CPI, inflation, and real wages, and why these concepts are important.
That's your Econ 101 segment for the month.
And Taki, we really need to do a longer session on inflation to
get into. There's so much to talk about.
So especially the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank's policies, and you know ways in which inflation can increase and the reasons why. But that's for a different day.
This is the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine. I'm Chris Sturr. I'm co-editor of Dollars and Cents Magazine, and I'm here with John Miller, who's one of our columnists. He writes the Up Against the Wall Street Journal column, and he's here to talk to us about his latest article, which is in our September-October issue, which is about the so-called millionaire's tax that passed in November of 2022 in Massachusetts. Why don't you start us off, John, by telling us what the millionaire's tax, it was really called the fair share tax. Just tell us like what its provisions are.
The fair share amendment, which was passed in November of 2022, but it's been proposed before, and actually Arthur McEwen, our Dr. Dollar, and I both testified for it before state legislature in 2015. What it is an additional tax on million-dollar earners in Massachusetts. Supposedly, progressive Massachusetts has a flat 5% income tax, and that will stay in place and only on income above a million. So it's on million-dollar earners, and only their income above a million will there be an additional tax, what an economist would call a surcharge, of 4%. So for their income over a million, they'll pay 9% now. That will roughly affect about 0.5% of taxpayers in Massachusetts, and most of it will not be paid by people that just make a million, but the majority of it will be, of the surcharge will be paid by people that have what's called adjusted gross income, more or less the amount of income that broadly is subject to taxation of over $5 million. So it's very well targeted at the most well-to-do taxpayers in Massachusetts. And you don't start paying until you've made over a million in 1 year. So that's the millionaire tax. It's even more specific than that. And it's an attempt to make everybody in Massachusetts pay their fair share of taxes, hence the fair share amendment.
Okay, so one little follow-up question for you is, you say income, but does income include things like capital gains? Like if I sell my house for a windfall profit, is that gonna?
Yes, capital gains are taxed in the federal tax code at a lower rate. It's taxed in Massachusetts at a favorable rate, and it's included. Now, one of the critiques of the Fair Share Amendment is, oh my God, I bought a house and the only time I had a chance to really make some money is from the housing boom and the appreciation of the value of the house. Now, you would have to make over $1 million in a gain. First, if you bought a house for $1 million and you sold it for $2 million, if you're married, you'd get a $500,000 deduction. So you would have $500,000 subject to the tax. Now, in 2020, there were just 895 gains that exceeded $1 million or would have been subject to the tax on, I guess that means exceeded $1.5 million in Massachusetts. And they were concentrated in the islands populated by the rich off Massachusetts, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard and Weston, which is the richest community in the Boston metropolitan area. So it's extremely well targeted, even with its tax on homeowners who make a huge one-time profit.
All right, so your column is a response to the business press and to the business-oriented PR and think tank world. And in this column, you respond to the complaints that the Boston-based Pioneer Institute has about the Fair Share Amendment. So why don't you just summarize what their criticisms are?
The Pioneer Institute is the premier free market think tank. They've done battle with this for ever since it first was proposed in 2015. Well, one of the usual critiques, and they have us, that we're killing the rich, we're going to make them pay an inordinate amount of taxes. And they say, well, look, the rich pay most of the taxes in Massachusetts. Well, that's quasi true because the rich have most of the money in Massachusetts. But if you actually look at their tax burden, not the amount of money you turn over to the state in taxes, but how much it hurts you relative to your income. In 2018, which is the latest data we have, what an economist would call the effective tax rate, or the percentage of your income that you hand over to the state and local governments in the form of taxes, it was 6.5% for the top 1%. For the other 99% of taxpayers, it was 9.1%. And for the bottom 20% who have a small income and pay a disproportionate amount of sales taxes, or if you're renters, you're, you know, what you pay in rent is jacked up to help pay for the property taxes of the owners, they pay 10%. Now, even after the 4% charge, the effective tax rate of people at the top 1%, all of whom make over $903,000 a year in 2023, is going to be 9.2%. So almost identical to everybody else. So this is not asking the richest of the rich to pay anything more than we're asking everybody else to pay relative to their income.
Right. So, okay. So they don't seem to be right about the fairness issue, at least if effective tax rates are a good measure of fairness, which I think most people agree with. But anyway, so what about their claims about out-migration? They say that this is going to drive...
Oh, we're going to go broke.
We're going to go broke because this is going to drive...
Massachusetts is going to go broke. Well, yeah. Let me read the title of the particular article that I criticized. It's called "The Net Out-Migration of Wealth from Massachusetts Nearly Quintupled from 2012 to 2021. So the argument is, if you tax them, they will leave. Now, there's a couple of things to note about this data they're presenting, and even is evident in the title. One, it's 2012 to 2021. The fair share tax went into effect this year. Right. So this is all projection based upon the reputation of Massachusetts being a high tax state, which when you really look at it, the evidence is very mixed about that. We're not the highest, but we're not the lowest. We're on the high side. And then they say, well, now you've added this additional tax, it's going to get worse. Now, the other thing that's in the title is it's the wealth moving out that they're talking about. It's disproportionate amount of wealth. What we know is Massachusetts is a very rich and very unequal economy. So the wealth is concentrated at the top. So it's not about the out-migration of people. But even when you look at that data, and the typical way you look at it without getting into the numbers much is you look at people that have under 200,000 and over 200,000, only 2/5 of the people over 200,000 would ever pay this tax. But their out-migration is slower than people that have less than $200,000. If you look at the wealth, we lose 1.5% of the wealth of the people at the very top, which is a big number because they have a lot of wealth, and we only lose 3.5% for the bottom. So there's not a disproportionate amount of wealth coming from the top. So you think, well, wait a minute, it can't be taxes that explain this. And if you'll ask another way, who are the people that are going by their age group? The fastest groups leaving Massachusetts are 26 to 35 and 18 to 26. They're leaving because they can't afford housing in Massachusetts. So by all those standards, it's not likely that people are leaving because of high taxes in Massachusetts, or in particular, the imposition of a surcharge that hasn't even taken effect when they collected their data.
You have a sidebar in your article that's about the experience of, what are the other states? You looked at New Jersey.
New Jersey is the first one.
Okay.
So yeah, in Maryland. New Jersey increased the tax on earners over $500,000. They found that there was a small out-migration. Nonetheless, their tax revenues went up, so it didn't offset the effect of the tax. And when they looked further, they thought there was no evidence that there was going to be any trend. And Chris Christie was the governor. He said, if you tax them, they will leave. And the evidence was that the out-migration rate in New Jersey was a smidgen higher for people over 500,000 than under 500,000. So that didn't hold up. Maryland's the best case. Maryland, in 2008, you know, just before the financial crisis really takes hold, the Great Recession, they impose a tax on their million-dollar earners. And then the Wall Street Journal published an article that in the subsequent 2 years, a third of the million-dollar earners in Maryland disappeared. And if you look at the tax data, there were, of the taxpayers, they were a third lower that had earned over a million.
2 years later.
Well, what happened was they lost money, or their incomes got slaughtered in the downturn. And when the tax authorities actually went and looked at the numbers, they said, oh no, those people, they're all here. They're just in the next lower tax bracket.
Right.
And then in California, Proposition 30, they posed some higher rates, 500,000 and above. They got a little out migration. Still at the very top, the number of Forbes 400 richest, they went up. And we also know that the amount they lost, all as in New Jersey, didn't decrease tax revenues, but tax revenues increased. And when the California tax authorities actually looked into all the details, they said, yeah, there was an out migration, but it was a one-time movement, and there's no evidence that it continued after 1 year. And then there was still more people coming in at the very tippy top.
Right.
So what it says is this can work.
Yeah. Okay. So if it can work, maybe you can tell us what you found about, or what the research shows about how much Massachusetts can expect to bring in the way of additional revenue. And then the other thing that I thought was really interesting about your article was, you know, you've said that if you really look at the numbers, the actual out-migration is from younger and lower income people who can't afford the state. So, and I liked what you said about how the spending from this new revenue might help make the state more affordable and more attractive for lower income people.
Yeah. So it looks like initially we're going to get about 800 million in 2023. And that's the most conservative study that has the greatest negative reaction to the Fair Share Amendment. And others study suggests as much as $2 billion, right? The money that they're using now in 2023 is going to go to transportation and improving transportation with the intent of making it easier for low-income people to find jobs further away from their home, to helping to finance community colleges, making it more accessible to more people, and providing universal free lunches to free meals in public schools throughout Massachusetts. You know, we also need to spend money to do something about housing in Massachusetts. Our housing costs are on average, the highest of any state in the union. And Boston's housing rental prices are second only to San Francisco. You know, people from 36 younger are the ones that really are being priced out. We've got a lot of higher education. If we're going to have an effective workforce, we have to find ways to make them make Massachusetts a place that they can stay and work and thrive. And at the end of the article, I say, well, I think the real lesson of the data is, you know, tax fairly and spend wisely and they will stay. We've yet to prove that will really work, but I do think that's what the data suggests.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Chris. I really enjoyed it.
All right. Take care. This has been the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine. For more economic analysis, visit dollarsandcents.org.
3, 2, 1.
Here we go!
I'm Casey Bixon, producer of Siren Song, a show featuring music and interviews with a spotlight on local, national, and international artists who identify as women, femme, non-binary, and gender non-conforming. Each week, a different host guarantees each show is a unique journey with an eclectic mix of music from across the style spectrum. Tune in every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. or stream us live at kkfi.org/listen. Join KKFI on November 2nd at Drexel Hall at Kansas City Iris Center for Music Unites, featuring Calvin Arsenia and Friendly Thieves. Music Unites, a benefit for KKFI, brings together the community for a special night of music. Doors open at 7:30, the concert starts at 8. Go to kkfi.org to purchase tickets and to learn more.
August 8, 2023, deadly wildfires ravaged Hawaii, killing over 100 people. Hundreds are still missing. The fires were centered on the island of Maui, where they destroyed much of the historic city of Lahaina, and is a serious contender for the distinction of the deadliest wildfire in the U.S. in more than a century. 2023 has been a record catastrophic year for weather and climate disasters across the nation. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, by early September, the U.S. had recorded a thumping 23 separate weather and climate disasters, leading to $1 billion in damage. We don't have a consolidated number of the human lives and livelihoods lost and communities destroyed. So to discuss how all of these disasters are connected to our economic system, we have with us Professor Raja Swami. Professor Swami is an anthropologist who researches the political economy of disasters. His book, Building Back Better in India, Development, NGOs, and Artisanal Fishers After the 2004 Tsunami, looks at how artisanal fisher communities in southern India fared in the context of a recovery project that sought to displace them in the name of Building Back Better. In Houston, his research examines how elite-friendly hurricane recovery efforts sidelined struggles by poorer, predominantly minority communities to address slower forms of long-term harm in toxic neighborhoods. Professor Swami teaches anthropology at the University of Tennessee. Raja, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So you've been working on the issue of disaster capitalism for some time, and or disasters and the impact it has on communities. So this, you know, like in the introduction, I mentioned these wildfires in Hawaii and Canada. There was, of course, California has been experiencing floods and wildfires and, horrific fires in Australia in 2020. We've seen disasters in Puerto Rico. We've even seen severe flooding in where we are at in Missouri in 2022. So the list goes on. And so many people, you know, might, you know, people might consider these as individual, separate instances of natural disasters. So are they, in fact, unconnected and an unfortunate series of catastrophes?
Oh, actually, I mean, you listed quite an exhaustive number of, you know, it's a pretty exhaustive list what you, you know, you pointed to. And this is planetary, right? And so part of the burden with our long-term understanding of quote-unquote natural disasters is that sense that these are natural things, right? That they happen because nature somehow kind of intervenes in the course of human life, and you know, then our real question is how do we get back to normal? So, but it, as you pointed out, clearly there's something going on that's pointing to something, you know, a much more complex set of affairs. So, you know, 2022 and 23 have been pretty intense. Yet what we're seeing now is a planetary kind of shift that's taking place. And in June 2023, for example, we saw some of the highest global average temperatures on record in more than 100,000 years. And climate scientists have sort of, you know, identified this as one of the hottest years in, you know, not just in during the period that we've been recording, which we can actually estimate based on the science. And some of the highest ocean surface temperatures, as well as the lowest sea ice coverage ever recorded. So we are in an era of increasing catastrophic climate, and this is being manifested in a range of disasters that are now affecting, you know, truly on a planetary scale, human population spread across many, many different countries and across all the continents. It is not like these, of course, not unconnected, unfortunate series of catastrophes. I mean, of course, unfortunate, but these catastrophes can only be understood by linking them together and seeing what is going on, what the common denominators are. And clearly, the common denominators here have to do with global warming and the kind of ways in which human activity across the planet, driven largely by a kind of fossil fuel economic order, has really exacerbated these processes, made existing climate patterns sort of either made them really unstable or increased the intensity of certain kinds of, you know, normal events such as storm systems and heating and cooling of the planet. So, yeah, we are in a kind of an era of catastrophic climate change right now.
Yes. And, you know, I see among people, particularly young people, this climate anxiety too, right? Because the scale of what is happening is so huge. But yes, so climate change, yes, but is there anything else? Is there anything else that kind of devastation that we're seeing among communities? You know, there is the natural disaster element of it. But, you know, do businesses, the state or the response of the state, you know, the ways in which markets and economies operate, do they have any role to play in how things are unfolding?
Absolutely. I mean, and part of the challenge really is to really question the quote-unquote naturalness of natural disasters. We can no longer sort of sit smugly and think that, you know, humans are just going about their business while nature comes and kind of beats us up once in a while. What is happening is intimately connected to how we are ourselves caught within a certain set of processes that are linked very intimately to, you know, the economic and social worlds that have been produced on the planet. I want to kind of, like, you know, maybe use the example of what's happened in Hawaii with the wildfires, the deadly wildfires. Now, one of the things that has been brought up, and this is by a scholar, a legal scholar from Hawaii, Kapuala Sproat, who mentioned recently that, you know, what she sees happening in Hawaii is a direct result of the sort of colonial capitalist order that has been imposed on Hawaii. And this, you know, in order to understand this, one cannot only look at, you know, the one or two causes, but actually, you know, look at this historically of what has happened in terms of the complete kind of separation or the complete kind of gap between kinds of, you know, economic interests are driving the economy of Hawaii, while you know, people are struggling and facing the consequences of that economic order. The course of the wildfires is a term, plantation disaster capital. Disaster capitalism is a term that has become popular ever since Naomi Klein and others began to use this term in back in 2007 or so, to look at how, you know, disasters sort of provide, you know, are seen by capitalist interests as sort of as opportunities for investment, opportunities to, you know, make a quick buck. And, you know, there's a lot of sort of greed and opportunism involved in the process. But what Kapwala's quote brings up is this idea of plantation disaster capitalism, in that, you know, Hawaii's economy can only be understood in reference to its sort of plantation colonial history. And one of the things that has happened in this region, particularly in Maui and the western part, Lahaina, is that the water resources of this place have been, like, you know, drastically part of an extractive economic system where plantations, large plantation agricultural interests, have for, you know, not for 10 or 20 years, but for literally more than a century, have dominated, right? And they've taken control of this water in order to grow, like, you know, various kinds of cash crops like pineapples and so on. So that has already produced a kind of an environmental inequality, mm-hmm. right, in terms of who gets resources, who can access water, so on and so forth. So native Hawaiians have been denied water that has been funneled by these plantation interests for decades now, for more than a century. Mm-hmm. Now, in the course of doing this, what has happened is that the depletion of water has led to the various kinds of invasive vegetation, particularly grasses, to proliferate on the island. Right? So parts of Lahaina then became, you know, filled with various kinds of grasses, and these grasses, with increasing temperatures, basically became fuel for the wildfire. So in the wildfire, the spread and intensity of the wildfire cannot be understood outside of, you know, can only be understood but in reference to what has happened in a kind of longer-term historical process. Right. The ecological transformation has opened up this place, made it far more vulnerable. Now, what is plantation disaster capitalism, according to Dr. Sproat? Basically, what has happened is that prior to the wildfire, Native Hawaiians had been mounting a long-term struggle against private interests and the state to get some kind of respite with regard to water rights, right? Have a more equitable water allocation process. Now, this struggle was moving along, and they had managed to win some rights until the point when the wildfire struck. And as the wildfire happened, the governor immediately, under the rubric of the emergency, immediately suspended all these rights and pushed back against these gains, and again made water kind of much more put water back on the table as something that should be dominated by private interests and by the state's decisions to use water in particular ways that are conducive to economic recovery and so on and so forth, which basically means, again, privileging plantation agriculture, privileging tourism, privileging the interests of the big landowners, so on and so forth, over and above native Hawaiian communities. So this kind of opportunism, again, you know, tells us that disasters are moments where there's kind of almost it's becoming a routine process by which the disaster becomes an opportunity to win concessions and to push back against public and popular interests and needs. And in Hawaii, this again, like in Puerto Rico, one cannot understand these processes without reference to the colonial histories of these places.
Right.
And the ways in which the local populations have historically been marginalized and have been at the receiving end of power structures with extractive kinds of economies where, you know, they are losing already in the normal scope of, you know, things, they're already losing out.
Right. Raja, you know, I'm so glad you brought up this issue of naturalness, right? Like, how do we understand the environment as natural, given that we are part of it and, you know, we do impact it so significantly? And, you know, thank you also for bringing up this issue of colonialism and, you know, the ways in which, sort of these economic and political structures have impacted and have brought us to this point in our society. So given this ongoing war in the Middle East, could we briefly address that? How would we understand a disaster in that context? If you could just very briefly give us your thoughts on that.
Palestine is a classic example of historical context being incredibly important to an understanding of, you know, what is happening now, both, you know, socially, politically, and ecologically and environmentally as well. But aside from the terrifying brutality that's happening now with the Israeli state bombarding the people of Gaza and, you know, thousands dead and so on and so forth, the normal conditions prevailing in Palestine are actually quite comparable to what has been happening in Hawaii. And let's just focus on water, since water is also an important issue in Palestine as it is in Hawaii. Just focusing on water, right? Even under quote-unquote normal conditions, there is an extractive logic that is at play in Palestine. Mm-hmm. And it is tied to a settler colonial system that actually allocates a majority of the water. 87% of the water is claimed by Israel. 13% of the water is allocated to Palestine. Right? The population breakdown is roughly 50-50 now, with, you know, the Israeli population and the Palestinian people. Now, while this allocation itself is so, you know, starkly disparate, one has to also take into consideration not only the long history of settler colonialism and so on, but the ways in which everyday violence and the indignities of an apartheid kind of system and routine dispossession are made worse by the sort of total control by Israel of a vital resource like water. So, you know, when water is available to people, how much water is available, the quality of water, etc., for Palestinians is always up for grabs, even under normal circumstances.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Professor Rajaswami on disaster capitalism. One of the things that happened in Hawaii is that days after the blaze began, survivors started reporting cold calls from out-of-state investors hoping to swoop in and purchase property at bargain bin prices. And this is not something that's new, though, you know, when I first heard it, like, I just, you know, I felt the chill run up my spine. We've heard stories like this when Hurricane Michael struck the Florida panhandle in 2019, we know that home prices increased by 15% for the first half of the year in the Florida county that was hardest hit by the Category 5 storm. So these, you know, how do we understand these kind of, you know, and you've in your book actually talked about something called disaster-ridden horizon of neoliberalism, or, you know, another form of capitalism, right? So are disasters opportunities for profit-making and power accumulation? Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Let's think about this in a sort of broader systemic historical sense. What we are seeing is basically the kind of the playing out of a logic that, you know, is driven by this understanding that private-led, private interest-oriented strategies are the best way forward. So public interest is now, you know, can only be addressed through private-led initiatives, right? If the public wants health, well, let's look for answers to the HMOs, or, you know, let's look, the public wants education, let's think about privatized education, right? This is sort of the dominant logic. Now, this is playing out in the context of disaster as well. So, you know, in disaster context, we're seeing variously, you know, all kinds of strategies that are now, you know, linked to revitalizing economies, revitalizing societies, rebuilding devastated landscapes, but led by private interests. Right? And these are seen as economic strategies, right? Whether it's to revitalize tourism, or production, or, as even democratic socialists in the United States like to keep saying, to put people back to work. Right? These are supposedly best addressed only through private interests sort of being the leaders of these processes. Now, for a lot of people around the world who are who suffer from disaster situations, there's also another set of private interests that are seen to be responsible for their needs, and those are these humanitarian organizations. Mm-hmm. So you've got either private capitalist interest directly kind of playing a role in the kind of rebuilding of devastated places, or you've got humanitarian benevolence now dominating these areas, providing various kinds of benefits. Now, what I find really interesting in this transformation is that, one, you start seeing how disasters are becoming opportunities for various kinds of private initiatives at the cost of public needs and public interest. Now, what might have been in pre-disaster times viewed by populations as entitlements, right? Housing as a right, water as a right, etc. In the context of disaster capitalism, become viewed as privileges or gifts that are that come out of the benevolence of various kinds of private humanitarian organizations, etc., or through the brilliance of some corporation that comes and kind of develops some kind of reconstruction process, and so on and so forth. So what we're seeing in disaster capitalism per se is that there are continuities between what is happening before the disaster, that is how states and private corporations are involved in various strategies in order to kind of either invest in a place or to push people out or to privatize certain resources or to build certain kinds of factories or to create transformations that run directly into public opposition. And in the context of a disaster, suddenly the disaster becomes an opportunity to push these very processes through now that people are struggling and suffering. So whatever was prevented prior to the disaster now becomes possible. And you see this in Hawaii with water. But you also saw this in New Orleans in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina, the decimation of unions, the privatization of schools. And in the post-tsunami context in India in 2004, you saw the concerted effort by the government and a host of multilateral organizations to use the tsunami as an excuse to push coastal fishing communities inland so you can open up the coast for investment. You also saw this with Hurricane Harvey and post-Harvey, the Texas Commission for Environmental Quality basically rubber-stamped industrial the petrochemical industry's demands for various kinds of permits, right, to increase emissions and so on and so forth. Things that would have been resisted and kind of pushed back against prior to the disaster now become possible under the cloud of economic recovery. See, if you want economic recovery, allow corporations to do what they want.
Yes.
Right? Ease back on your opposition to environmental standards, to protecting jobs, to land rights. Ease back opposition to water privatization. Right? In order for us to have economic recovery. So this dominant logic in the neoliberal globalization era has tended to inform the ways in which governments and private corporations are able to have their way in the context of in the post-disaster context.
Yeah.
This is the sort of nitty-gritty of disaster capitalism as I understand it.
So what has been happening? And you've worked extensively. You talked about tsunami you've worked with communities that were impacted by the 2004 tsunami, but you are also very heavily involved in communities in Houston that were impacted by Hurricane Harvey in 2017. And you have written about how, just what you talked about, the impact of NGOs and humanitarian aids, but also of corporations, and such an important issue to highlight and really talk about it. But in addition, you've also, a lot of your work has very consciously centered the voices of the impacted communities and the ways in which they have been challenging this kind of view of disasters as potential for profit making, and they've challenged the kind of power accumulation that has been going on. So what do these voices, these real life stories, what do they reveal, and how do they, can we think about learning from them? Like, how do we collectively ensure that economic growth and profits do not happen at the expense of people and their well-being?
Yeah, one thing that I learned from listening to conversations happening at the local level is that folks at the receiving end of power more broadly, not just disaster situations, but you know, folks who are kind of, you know, already embattled, right? Whether through toxic pollution, Black and Latinx communities in Houston, or, you know, embattled in terms of land claims and the kind of efforts to push them off the land in the coastal parts of Tamil Nadu state in India, is that people at the ground level actually have an incredibly sharp sense of what the stakes are, right? And they understand the claims being made in ways that many of us tend not to. When the government says economic growth, when the government says development, when the government says recovery, you know, they immediately, you know, they have their, you know, for us, we have to kind of make an effort to put our critical, you know, switch on and start thinking, okay, what do they actually mean? But folks on the ground generally tend to understand immediately, okay, what does this mean in terms of livelihood? What does it mean in terms of, you know, my well-being? What does it mean in terms of the ways in which, like, you know, the government has been riding roughshod over our interests, or these private corporations have been polluting our land, etc. Right? They ask the questions that often academics and scholars, like, you know, think they had a great Eureka moment many years later, mm-hmm. figuring out these things. But, you know, folks on the ground tend to have this understanding. Now, what I have found really helpful is to understand not only how people see and experience these things and speak to these things, but also how they organize, how they fight back, and understand, like, the ways in which people are struggling back, or struggling for their rights, not only in the aftermath of a disaster, but how those struggles connect to the struggles that were happening before the disaster. So in India, in the southern state of Tamil Nadu, in coastal part of Tamil Nadu, a district called Nagapattinam, I was astonished with the level of politicization among coastal artisanal fishing communities. And, you know, they work at a level where, you know, they link their everyday struggles for livelihood with the kinds of, you know, objectives of recovery, right? Or the struggles that are happening within these communities, right? For example, many of the organizers and the most militant voices within these communities are women who have been fighting for gender rights, gender equality within these communities for years, for decades, right? And they link their empowerment with the empowerment of the communities at large. Right? Yes. And those struggles, you know, oftentimes in disaster context, you know, people say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, that's all interesting and important, but, you know, how do we recover? Well, what does recovery mean if recovery is not connected to empowerment? Right?
Exactly.
Those kinds of questions need to be asked, I think. So when we think about, you know, artisanal fishing communities, or when we think about, like, you know, Black and Latinx working class communities in Houston, I think the primary questions to really ask are, what are people doing in terms of the everyday struggles? What are they doing in order to make life under conditions that are not of their own choosing, under conditions of duress? So
Thank
these are folks
you.
Who
yes.
are dealing with, you know, high rates of cancer, incredible amounts of pollution, plus also dealing with things like, you know, being picked up from the road by the police and deported, having their lives, you know, completely, you know, devastated by a kind of an intensely repressive state that looks suspiciously at every Latinx person. So, you know, having these kinds of realities govern their lives, one realizes then that disaster situations bring onto the surface long-term kinds of issues and struggles that are part and parcel of people's lives.
Yeah, thank you, Raja. Thank you so much. You know, this has been a very, very important conversation, and I'm so glad you were able to not just tell us how to think about disasters, but also how to think about disaster capitalism and what can be done to challenge it. We've been talking with Professor Raja Swami.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Sirija.
The views and opinions aired by the hosts and guests on the show do not reflect those of their employers, KKFI, or its board.
كان
Cielo, vamos. Caballito blanco, vuelve pa' tu pueblo. No te tenemos miedo, tenemos vida y fuego. Fuego en nuestras manos, fuego en nuestros ojos. Tenemos tanta vida y esta fuerza color rojo. La niña María no quiere tu castigo. Se va a liberar con el suelo palestino. Somos africanos, latinoamericanos. Somos este sur y juntamos nuestras manos. Todos los callados.